Hey everybody, I'm Tom and I'm an alcoholic. So the date of my last white chip, December 8th, 2018, I've got a home group, I've got a service position in that home group, and a sponsor who knows he's my sponsor. Like I bet most of the people in this room, I didn't come here willingly, or at least come here. It was something I resisted for a long time. Like probably a bunch of people here, I took longer than I should have, but boy am I glad I'm here. So my first white chip was sometime around August of 2018, so not that long ahead of time. And the way I got there was I got there from years and years of practice. But the immediately getting there was one day I told my wife, I think I have to go to AA. And her response was, really? And I took that as, okay, she doesn't think I have a problem. And I sat on that for a couple of months. And then finally, sometime in August, I got up the nerve to call a friend of mine who I knew was in the program. She was somebody who we knew each other through our kids. And really the only interaction we had really was around our kids. And so I called her one day and asked her how she was doing. And she clearly thought I was asking her to pick up my kids from school or something, because she started talking about how busy your day was and how, you know, she had this to do and that to do and this thing. And I said, yeah, so I think maybe I need to go to a meeting. And she said, when do you want to meet? Do you want to meet now? I can meet now. And was going to drop everything to then come and meet with me. And we met at a coffee shop, and I started talking about how things had gotten kind of out of control. And she said, you know, there's somebody who I think you should talk to. And she said, there's a guy, David, who's got some really good sobriety. Let me get him on the phone with you. So I'm on the phone with David, David F. And he started asking me about, like, you know, just whether or not I wanted to get together and maybe we can talk about it a bit. And where does he live? And he lived in my neighborhood. And I was like, what's the street? And he lived on my street. And I said, what number? And he told me the number, and I was like, oh, yeah, no, I live across the street from you. We've actually met. We met during, we exchanged phone numbers during a hurricane warning. And I was like, so yeah, okay, so I've got your number. You don't have to, I'll call you. So I went and had coffee at his house. He gave me a book and invited me to a meeting. And so I went to the A101 on Sunday morning I'm from Norfolk, A101 Sunday morning at the hospital. And boy, that meeting, David was great. He was very supportive the whole way through, sort of talking me through, you know, how it was going to go. But I remember shaking the whole time. And wanting to get up, but I can't get up now and leave. And I remember a couple of things. I remember people talking about these horrifying stories of institutions and near death, and this story of the jail sentence. And I remember thinking, yeah, that's not me. And all I could think about was the way in which I wasn't like the people in the room. And the other thing I remember about that day was how much people were laughing. And I thought, what is wrong with these people? I mean, there's nothing funny about this. Maybe they're all insane. And I remember the chips came up, and David says to me, you know, so they're gonna, there's a white chip. If you wanna just try this, you can get the white chip. And the white chip comes out, and I don't go and get it. And he goes, well, you know, there'll be another chance at it. You can, you can get a second chance, you might decide you want to. And I remember somebody getting a 9-month chip that day, and people applauded, and that person got a hug. And I was like, oh, that doesn't seem so bad. And the second chance at the white chip came up, and I dragged myself out of my seat, and I got the chip, and people were applauding. And I sat back down, and David's like, all right, so what's going to happen next? At the end of the meeting, a lot of people are going to come over. You're going to get a lot of phone numbers. Just take some phone numbers and be open-minded about it. So that was my first meeting. I'll get to the end of that meeting a little later. So how come I identified out so much? And a lot of that had to do with the way I grew up. So my first experience with recovery was when I was 7. My mom went into recovery. She went to Hazleton. I'm from Minnesota. And I remember my mom drinking. I remember her coming home from parties and slurring her words and falling down. I remember overheard conversations with my dad about how it happened again. I remember her trying to stop and not being able to. My mom, with both alcohol and cigarettes, it was the hiding things around the house kind of thing. And so finally she went to treatment. And my first meeting, which I thought was I spent all these years thinking was an open meeting of AA. I found out like months ago in talking to my parents, it was actually an Alateen meeting that my dad sent me and my sister to. And what I remember about that Alateen meeting was being deeply uncomfortable and people talking about their feelings and me feeling like I didn't belong there. Now, feeling like I didn't belong there wasn't because I felt different from the other people in the room. I just didn't like it. I never really liked crowds. I never really liked being with people. I just got a text the other day from a fellow introvert. And it was a little, you know, a text that they'd seen that was, there is nothing more unrelatable in all of Disney than Ariel singing about how she wants to be where the people are. And I was like, yeah, me too. I don't want to be where the people are ever. But I identified alcoholics as being the sloppy drunks like my mom. And then when I got into high school, my mom became a drug and alcohol counselor for the county. And there's not a lot that's going to make you, just the stories she would tell. And the fact that I would come home and she'd say, your pupils are dilated, are you on drugs? You're like, no, mom, I'm just tired. And I really was just tired. I was a really kind of straight kid. I never tried drugs in high school. My first experience with getting drunk was my freshman year. My parents had a liquor cabinet and I opened it up and I tried a little bit of everything, including maybe the last thing I tried, but the thing I remember most was a nice good shot of creme de menthe, right? And I got so sick. And I remember being hungover in my homeroom class the next morning and hating it. And I was like, why do people do this? And I remember that first meeting, people talking about how they'd get sick the first time, but then couldn't wait to go back out again. And that was not me at all. I was like, why would people want to do this? And so I didn't get drunk again until I was in college. And all that has to do with the fact that I was not a party kid in that crowd. I had, you know, a girlfriend who was pretty straight. And so it had more to do with probably my antisocial behavior than it had to do with the fact that I didn't like drinking. But I got to college having gotten drunk once. And before I got to college, my sister was a little older than me. She would come back from college and she would drink, and she'd drink like my mom. She would get sloppy. And I thought, well, I'm not like that. My sister and my mom are the sloppy drinkers, and I'm not going to be like that. And I remember my freshman year, I remember the first time I got sick was, we were drinking gin and tonics, and then we ran out of tonic, so drinking gin and gin. And I got terribly sick, and I hated it, and I didn't want to do it again. And I think I was lucky in that I would get sick before I would pass out, and I didn't like getting sick. So I drank in college, but not to excess, and I started enjoying it. Like, oh, I can like hang out in the crowd now. I can dance without feeling weird about it. I can talk to girls. All this stuff that I could not do before. I enjoyed it. And man, the coming home at Thanksgiving, I'm 18 years old, and my dad pours me a glass of scotch. And at that point, the drinking age in Minnesota is 19. But like, so I'm 18, but I'm in college now, so I'm a man. And sitting down with my dad and drinking scotch and playing cribbage, and I'm like, yeah, this is drinking like a gentleman right here. This is, I'm like my dad in drinking. And so I go through college, and at some point, like my senior year, my sister is getting worse, and we have an intervention. And so she stops drinking, but she doesn't go into the program. My mom, by the way, went through treatment but then, and became a drug and alcohol counselor, but was not in AA. So my sister stops drinking cold. And I'm like, thank God I'm not like that. I get to grad school and I'm drinking more, but it's not affecting much. You know, I remember there was a dive bar in Pacific Beach. I went to college, California. And there's a dive bar when I would walk in and they would put a double Jack Daniels and the rocks down. The bartender would see me and put it on the bar. And I thought, man, I've made it. This is great. I don't even have to order this. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the way it made me feel. I enjoyed feeling like I belonged somewhere. And I got out of college. I moved up to Los Angeles, and my brother moved in with me. We were living kind of next door to each other. And he was a party boy, frat boy drinker. I remember being at a party in the backyard and my brother stumbling around, and I was just thinking, thank God I'm not like that. And one day he crashed his car into a tree and quit drinking. I found out later he went to 30 meetings in 30 days, went back for his year chip, and those were the only meetings he ever went to. And he's still dry. He's dry though. But I was just like, man, I'm really grateful that I am not like that. At some point along the way, I became a daily drinker. I can't tell you when, but I drank every day. And it was the thing that let my shoulders drop. It was the thing that let me let go of the day. I rarely was a blackout drinker. I wasn't so much a party drinker. It was just the thing that allowed me to relax. And I would get sick occasionally. I would have a hangover occasionally, but not that often. Though over the years, that time got shorter and shorter between them. And at some point along the way, when I was 30, my sister died. By suicide, and I'll say I'm a big believer that it's wrong to oversimplify the reasons why somebody takes their own life. So I don't know why, but I'll tell you one thing that was really clear was that alcohol was not the problem; it was the solution to her problems, and she took that solution away and didn't replace it. And so one of the reasons I think my sister is no longer with us is untreated alcoholism. And when she died, and I was kind of the strong one in the family, I felt grateful that I was not like her. So I'm continuing my life of drinking more and more, and about 17 years ago, a guy comes into work for a professional development thing. I'm teaching high school at this point. And he's open about his alcoholism, not as a part of the thing. It's just something that he talks about as an alcoholic, blah, blah, blah. And we're having these one-on-one meetings with him. And I say, yeah, I think maybe I have a problem. And This was the day I learned that alcoholics can give really bad advice. And he said, well, you seem like you got your life pretty much together. And he's like, I tell you what, you can come to a meeting with me and see how you feel about it. And then I'd say, you know, if you can go 30 days without drinking or 30 days with only having one drink a day, then you're probably not an alcoholic. And I went to my first AA meeting about 17 years ago, and I didn't get up and get a chip. I didn't share. I just watched and identified out of that whole meeting. I don't remember anything about it other than being uncomfortable and feeling like I didn't belong. And then I went 30 days without drinking. I was like, let me prove to myself that I'm not an alcoholic. And I didn't actually do 30 days without drinking because I wanted to prove I wasn't an alcoholic. I was like, I'm going to go on Whole 30 and diet. And part of that diet is not drinking. But I didn't drink for 30 days. 31, I had a drink and continued drinking daily after that. But I felt like, oh, okay, I'm not an alcoholic. What I didn't try was drinking only one drink a day for 30 days because I'm not insane. I'm like, who would do that? And I can tell you, there's no way I could do that. But I never tried that. But I did the 30 days thing, so I'm like, I'm okay. And I continue on with my excessive drinking life, and things are getting just worse. Like, I haven't gotten a DUI, but it's just luck. I remember waking up out of a kind of blackout on the freeway near LAX. And did I pull over and call a cab? No, I kind of like made my way home. That happened a couple of times. And I remember a person on the freeway honking their horn at me, because obviously I was weaving. But I haven't had a DUI, so I'm probably okay. I just need to take it easy a little bit. And I just continued. I continued along my life there. I was terribly drunk the morning my first daughter was born. If my wife had gone into labor at 3 o'clock in the morning, I could have killed us all. But she didn't go into labor until 10, so I could drive with a terrible hangover, not drunk. And I continued with this idea that I was like my dad, not like my mom, my brother, and my sister. And then about 10 years ago, my dad stopped drinking. And I'm like, oh, damn it. If I'm like my dad, I'm actually now the only one in the family who's still drinking. And I probably can't pull the I'm like my dad thing anymore. And then there's another part of me that thinks, well, he made it to 70. Maybe I could do that. And I'll just keep drinking until I'm about 70 like my dad. And things are just getting worse. And the time between bad events is getting shorter. And finally, I get to the point where I say to my wife, I think I need to go to AA. So I go to that first meeting. And after the meeting, all these people come around me. And they're giving me phone numbers. And one guy, you know, he's got the meeting directory, because this is before the app, or at least the app wasn't a big thing. And he's circling meetings, like, go to this meeting and this meeting. And, oh, if you go to this meeting, this is a pretty hardcore one. You can see, like, some really low-bottom folks. And as he's going through all of this, I say, man, I actually don't know if I belong here. I mean, I've been drinking too much, but it's gone from, like, a quarter of a bottle of whiskey to a third to a half a day. And I'm just drinking too much. And he says, dude, normal people don't do that math. What he said next, I can't say in this church, but he said, you are just like the rest of us when it comes to alcohol. You're not a unicorn, which I took kind of personally. I'm like, he doesn't know me. I could be a unicorn. But so I start going to AA, and I stop drinking, and I start going to AA, and I start shopping around for a sponsor, because I want to find the right one. And it's not the guy across the street, because that's a little too close. And it's not this guy who said I wasn't a unicorn. And I keep meeting people who are not quite right. I'm like the Goldilocks of, you know, AA. And I read the whole book. I read a book from cover to cover by myself, and found all the ways in which I didn't belong. And it's great reading what you guys, this is the first meeting I've been to that's read that reading, which was so important to me, reading the book, because I was like, oh, maybe I'm not a real alcoholic. Maybe I'm just a problem drinker. And I consider myself, you know, maybe I'm a high-functioning alcoholic, but not a real alcoholic. I'm a drinker, but I'm pretty good at it. I called myself a professional drinker a bunch of times. I would laugh at people who would get sick, and I was like, I was good at it. And I'm going to these meetings, and I keep seeing the ways I don't belong. There's a guy who comes to the meeting with his kids one day, and then I see him the next day at Simple Actions, and I say, hey, how old are your kids? You know, my kids are about the same age. And he tells me, and he's like, how often do you get to see him? And I'm like, we're still together, my wife and I. And there's this moment of, well, the assumption is if you're in these rooms, you've burned your life to the ground and you don't get to see your kids anymore. And there was a part of me that felt like, yeah, so therefore I don't belong. But there was also a part of me that went, yeah, this is where I'm heading. I wasn't able to laugh that one off the way I was a lot of these other things. And I tore my Achilles playing soccer, and I felt really proud of myself that the fact that I had had this injury didn't lead me to drink. I'm like, that proved something to me, that I could go through this terrible injury and not drink over it. So therefore, maybe I don't really belong here. In the meantime, I'm not telling anybody that I'm going to the rooms. My wife knows, but that's the list. There's a guy who I run into who I know through work a little bit, so he knows I'm in, but I don't tell my parents, I don't tell my brother. I avoid going to the West Ghent meeting because that's a little too close to home and I don't want anybody to recognize me. And I'm not even really pretending like it's not that. I don't want to tell people, because when I go back out, I don't want them to say, weren't you an AA? Should you have a drink in your hand? And I don't want to have to explain to them, well, yeah, I went to AA, but I found out that I really didn't belong there, and I can actually drink like a normal person. I went there to get better. I don't want to have that conversation, so I just avoid telling people or going to places where people are going to know me. And it's getting closer to the holidays, and people are having parties, and I go to a party, and my wife has to leave early for work, and nobody at the party knows that I'm not drinking, and somebody hands me a glass of wine, and I just say, okay, and I start drinking. And it was not more complicated than that. It wasn't a bad day. It wasn't anything other than no one here knows, and maybe I can drink now. And that next month, man, there's very little in my life that was worse than knowing that I have a problem and not being able to do anything about it. And all the things that I was telling myself, like I don't drink at work, and I'm drinking at work. And I don't hide alcohol around, and I'm hiding alcohol. And I don't drink in the morning, and I'm drinking in the morning. And it's just getting really bad. I don't pass out in front of my kids, and I'm taking a nap on the floor downstairs. I mean, just like, it's getting bad. And the one guy who was in the rooms, who knew me, and obviously is not seeing me now. And by the way, so David lives across the street. I'm like closing the blinds to go get a drink, right? One of the worst moments was, so I tore my Achilles and I've got a boot on. And all these years that I thought I was good at being drunk, like I can walk in a straight line, like try doing that with a boot on. Like, it was suddenly, I literally can't get up my stairs to my the front door of my house. And I'm all I can think about is that David's watching me through the window and I got to get inside. So this is humiliation, just terrible humiliation. And this guy on December 7th texts me and says, "How you doing?" And I said, "Not good." He said, "Well, why don't you come to a meeting tomorrow?" And so December 8th, 2018, I go to a meeting Saturday morning at a church on Hampton. And I pick up the white chip the first time around. And it feels different. Like going to that meeting and listening to people sharing and sharing myself about, yeah, I'm back and it's been bad. And I don't feel like I don't belong there. And I get out of the meeting and I get a text from my brother. And the text says, "Thinking about you today." And I realize, oh yeah, this is the anniversary of my sister's death. And I call my parents and I say, "Hey, I just went to an AA meeting." And we cried and talked about it. And I called my brother. I'm like, okay, that's a little bit of a higher power moment right there. Now, cut to 9 months later, and I'm feeling pretty good in AA, and I say to my wife, "Hey, remember when you didn't think I belonged in AA?" And she goes, "What are you talking about?" I was like, "Well, when I said I think I should go to AA, and you said, really?" And she's like, "Yeah, I knew you had a drinking problem. I just thought the God thing would keep you out." Okay. Yeah, I wasn't quite as good at hiding that as I thought I was. And it was, I was, her experience with me and God was a Christmas Eve service a couple years before we got married. And I remember being in that service, and I grew up in a church. My folks are very involved in church. I respect what they have found in church, but I then just grew away from it. And it was a couple years before we got married, I was in a Christmas Eve service, and I just felt miserable and alone. And I felt like all these people here believe something that I don't, and I hate it. Not that I hate what they're believing, I hate feeling apart from it. I hate feeling like I would like to have what they have, but I don't. So I'm not gonna engage in that. So she took that as my feelings about a higher power. That feeling that I had in that church that night is the feeling I had that first day in AA. That feeling of being in a room full of people who had something I didn't have and feeling like I was apart from it, that I didn't belong. And what I found is that what you need is just a little willingness to do some work. So after I called, had that call with my folks and my brother, I picked up the phone and I called that guy who gave me the list and who said I wasn't a unicorn. And I said, "Hey, I came back to the meetings. You might have noticed I was gone. Will you be my sponsor?" He was like, "Yeah." We met. He took my book that David had given me and he wrote some simple things in it. Call 3 people a day. Go to 3 meetings, at least 3 meetings a week. Get a home group, get a service position, don't lie, read these pages every day. I'm probably a couple weeks into working with him and something happens at work where I tell a casual lie about something, just, you know, "Oh yeah, I sent that email, sorry you didn't get that." And it was bothering me. And I called a friend of mine in California who I was in the program and I said, "Hey, my sponsor said don't lie. He's just talking about lying about alcohol, right?" And he laughed. And I'm like, and man, I realized how much lying had just become a part of my DNA, like drinking had. One of the things that kept me out of the rooms was that every good memory I had had drinking around it. My wedding day. And even my kids being born, drinking was around it. Even though it made me miserable, it was still sort of a part of it. I just couldn't imagine who I would be without alcohol. It had been a part of my life for so long. So I started working the steps. I found a home group. And started slowly seeing how all the stories were actually about me and seeing the ways in which I was exactly like everybody else and how learning the things like, yeah, you haven't lost your family yet. You haven't gotten a DUI yet. And coming to grips with this idea that, yeah, I was really close to burning it all down. And I am incredibly lucky that I didn't. And also, that I've still got a lifetime of work ahead of me. You know, I started talking about the day I picked up my last white chip instead of my sobriety date. Because I'll tell you, I don't, most days I don't feel sober. I haven't had a drink in that time, and I have done enough work to keep from picking up again. But boy, do I know I've got a lot more work to do. And that my default is being lazy about it. And that it's like the picking up the pen and working on the fourth step, picking up the phone and making those calls, actually listening to other people's problems and not just thinking about what I could be doing other than talking to them. All of that is where my default settings are, is thinking about myself. And what I know, and I'll just say this, I'm deeply grateful for the opportunity to speak to you all, and it is mostly an entirely selfish reason in that it puts me a little further away from taking a drink. And that talking about this, sharing about it, is a great reminder of how badly I need it. Like the feeling right now in my body, like, is very similar to how it felt after about 5 drinks. Like early in sobriety, it was maybe a couple, right? But later it was like about a bottle in where I would start, my shoulders would start dropping and I would start feeling a little more present in my body. And I'm feeling that right now. And I'm just really grateful for it. And, you know, I think my folks are sober. You know, my mom, by the way, picked up again when she retired, and it got bad. And I am incredibly impressed and proud of her that not only did she stop and start throwing herself into service work. It wasn't AA, but it was service work in her church. She, both her and my dad have joined groups where they talk about being a parent of a child who died by suicide and sharing their experience, strength, and hope around getting through that process, and have do service work in their church in a way that is about getting outside of themselves and giving back. And it is a great example of how it is not too late to do that work. My mom, when she was 73, gave up regret for Lent? And like, for somebody who's lost a child, right? She gave up regret for Lent, and then it just changed her. And that next year, she said it was the happiest year of her life. And that's at 74. So wherever you are on your journey, you can still work on it, and you can still change, and you can still get better than where you are right now. And that idea is really important for me, because there are days where I'm like, is this it? And I'm incredibly lucky. I've got a family, I've got a career that I love most of the time. I've got two kids who are healthy, and there are still days where my brother and I talk about the fact that seeing what my sister's death did to my parents, knowing now what taking your own life does to the people around you, has taken that off the table for me and my brother. Like, that's something we wouldn't ever do, but it's something we think about. I think about it a whole lot less now. When I was drinking, I thought everybody thought about driving into oncoming traffic. I thought everybody, it was normal to think about driving into a pole on the freeway. I've come to learn that that's not what everybody's experience is. But I really thought that. You know, that's part of the craziness of this disease, is how normal you put it, or like, what, like, this is just normal life, right? And there's more out there. I don't have a last drunk low, right? I was in a series of kind of skidding along the bottom when I got that text. But I have one experience that was pretty bad. That was about a week before I ended up back in the rooms. And I am in a job where I spend a lot of time talking to big groups of people. And this particular event was me, I'm up and I'm supposed to be saying nice things about this production of Christmas Carol, and about the director and the designers and the actors. And I've got this entire group of people, and I am just drunk. I'm just drunk. And I'm standing up in front of this group of people, and I'm aware that I'm not slurring, but I'm not putting sentences together in a way that a regular person does. I can see my wife sees that I'm, oh, you're in that place. And I kind of get through it, but it was bad. It was exactly the opposite of what I'm supposed to be doing, celebrating these other accomplishments. And the opportunity then to work on Christmas Carol myself, and to do it not drinking, to work on that play, on that story, that is about a man who has isolated himself from the entire world. That somebody who only thinks of themselves, and who has cut out any kind of warmth or compassion for either people who are close to him, like his nephew, or people who are in trouble, who he has no connection to. He has built a life that is around solitude, and the only thing that I need to take care of is my own greed. And he is then visited by spirits that show him what his path could have been as a young man, and the choices he made that have led him to this present. These spirits that show him people who are living full and happy lives, despite not having wealth, but having family and having care of each other. And then the spirit shows him this isolated and dreadful future that if he continues on this road, where he will end up alone and in a grave. And Scrooge is given the opportunity to change, that this man who has spent all these years isolating himself and pushing everybody away, by virtue of seeing what the past and what the future could be, he changes. And he drops to his knees and he says a prayer. And that prayer is answered. And he is given an opportunity to rejoin the community and be a friend, be a father figure to Tiny Tim. And I've been around Christmas Carol my whole life, and I never saw myself as Scrooge. And then I'm working on it, and I'm like, oh, this is a story about me. This is a story about what, about this promising future and how I was going down a path that was going to end up isolated, alone, and dead. And AA has given me an opportunity to forge a new future, forge a new path, and to be present for my family and my community around me. A couple of things that have happened in sobriety. I lost my dog a little over a year ago, a year and a half ago. And that dog had been with me for 12 years. Had been with my kids since before they were born. And my dog got sick. And the night before she passed, before I took her to the vet and had her put down, she was in terrible shape. And I had the choice, it was during COVID, so I had the choice of taking her out to some place where I would have had to drop her off, like not allowed to go in the middle of the night. Or I could wait with her until the morning and take her to the vet. And there's not a chance I could have done what I did when I was drinking, which is stay up with my dog, be with her, wake my kids up, say it's time to say goodbye to Zita. My 8-year-old is her first experience with death. She didn't want anything to do with it, but I was able to be with her. And I have this picture on my wall that is the kids, my two daughters and the neighbor boy across the street who came over around my dying dog, started drawing pictures. And being able to be there with my dog who was dying, with my kids processing their grief through art, was something that was only possible in being sober. This summer, I went through a reading jag with my 8-year-old, where we were reading all the Roald Dahl books. And I remember, my daughter is mostly a mama's girl, but this was the thing that would allow us to connect. And I remember having a moment where I was like, I wonder why my older daughter didn't like these books as much. I guess she just wasn't, she's a big reader, but I guess she just didn't like reading with me. And I was at my home group meeting, and I realized, no, dummy, it's not that she didn't like reading with you, it's that you were drunk during this time. Is that during the time when she'd be going to bed, you were just drinking yourself into oblivion, and you just missed that. You missed that, like, 2-year window with my older kid. And I came home that night after that meeting, and I sat down with her, and I made amends. And she just said how glad she was that I wasn't drinking and that it was okay. And we hugged, and I cried a little bit. And I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to finish reading Christmas Carol to my younger daughter, because she saw the show last week, and then she took the book out of her library, and we've been reading it, and she's really into it. And I get to go home tonight and read to my little girl. And that's only possible because of the work I do here in AA. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom.